Our last speaker is from the United States Food and Drug Administration, Catherine Vassenbrock, who's the director of the Inorganic Branch, the Forensic Chemistry Center in Cincinnati. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm really excited to talk about some of the work that we've done in our laboratory. And the work that I'll present today is all about the investigation of EVALI in the United States at our lab. So I thought I would start by giving a little bit of an introduction to my laboratory. Many people are not aware that FDA has a forensic center. They do, and that's us. We do analysis to support both regulatory FDA and criminal investigations involving FDA-regulated products. Those investigations center upon product tampering, product counterfeiting, and consumer complaints primarily. We also do research to develop methods and evaluate new technologies to be useful in FDA investigations. And we also become involved in emergency response, such as the response to the public health crisis involving EVALI. So we became involved in this project back in August of 2019. We received some information that there were some unexplained illnesses of young people that seemed to be associated with a small geographic area, just a couple of states, and a group of people. So as we started receiving samples, we recognized some significant challenges to this work. And these challenges that we as part of these initial submissions, continued for all the samples that we received. The first and really important challenge is that we received very limited volume for testing of these products. Most of the products that we received had been previously used. And when you think of a THC vape cartridge, a full cartridge would have about 600 to 800 milligrams of material. And these cartridges were primarily used, so they had less product than that. And on the nicotine side, the products that we received, typically a full tank or pod would have 1 5 mils of material, and of course we had less than that. Many of the samples that we received were just a residue, like not even enough material to remove from the cartridge. And many of them were unlabeled. And especially when we're talking about residues, it was difficult to tell in many cases by looking at the product what type of product it was supposed to be, which made deciding what kind of testing to begin with difficult. We also had a myriad of potential target analytes. At this point, essentially the whole universe of chemical contaminants were potential causative agents. Pesticides, metals, volatile organics, and other things were batted around as potential targets. And so we needed to be able to capture the widest range of chemical contaminants in the testing that we did. Patients were using multiple product types. They were vaping THC and nicotine products and a wide variety of those. So we couldn't zero in on a particular product type in our testing. They're using multiple types. Our laboratory also had limited experience with these kind of products, especially on the THC side. So we had to do some initial work to bring our methods into alignment with what we needed for this type of work. So in our initial approach, we did a number of non-targeted tests on both THC and nicotine products. Now, these initial tests, including GCMS and LCMS, ICP-MS, all of these testing is dependent on the idea that there was enough material received to test. And then we also did some targeted testing on both the nicotine and THC products. With all of this testing, we were looking at a multiple range of products and trying to find some things that were in common. As we started receiving more samples, it became clear that this was a problem that was pervasive throughout the United States, and so we didn't think that it was a particular brand or type of product that was implicated. And of course, it wasn't possible to do all of this testing on every submission because of limitations of amount. Okay, on the THC side, the materials were very difficult to work with because if you can imagine that the samples that we received on the THC side were often more viscous than honey, and so we would receive things that look like these cartridges. The one on the left is about half full, and then the one on the right is just a residual amount of liquid. And so we had to devise some way to remove the liquids from the cartridges. And so we ended up using a centrifuge technique, which other laboratories have also used, where we take the cartridge and remove the top and then put it in the pipette with the vial in the centrifuge tube, centrifuge it, and then eventually we get some material to test. And so we had to go through this process with every sample that we received. And so when we talk a little bit more about the number of samples that we received, this became a significant part of our analysis. Okay, so these are some examples of THC products that we received. We received probably every kind of vaping product that's out there in a myriad of different configurations of cartridges, tanks, pods, etc. So in all cases on the THC side, you have an extract from the cannabis plant. There are a variety of techniques that can be used to get that extract. And then the materials typically have delta-9 THC plus other cannabinoids that would be co-extracted with the delta-9 THC, as well as terpene solvents and a myriad of other things. On the nicotine side, the products were generally composed of vegetable glycerin, propylene glycol, nicotine, and flavors. And then again, some examples of different configurations of products that we received. So we decided to start our testing with FTIR and Raman analysis for a couple of reasons. First, because they use minimal sample. In the case of Raman, if we had a cartridge that had enough material in it, we could test the product right in the cartridge. It's a rapid analysis, and we can easily discern between THC and nicotine products so that we can get those products into the correct analysis stream. And using this testing, we can detect THC, vitamin E acetate, and indications that there may be other components present for the THC products. And then on the nicotine side, we can detect glycerol and propylene glycol. The nicotine isn't present at a high enough concentration for us to detect using this technique. So then following that initial screening by FTIR, we would do non-targeted screening by GCMS, assuming that there's enough product. And in using this testing, we can get a tremendous amount of information. We can identify delta-9 THC and other cannabinoids that would typically be present in this kind of product, as well as terpenes, and then diluents such as vitamin E acetate, medium chain triglycerides, polyethylene glycol, oligomers, and some other things. And then we would quantitate the delta-9 THC and other cannabinoids. Typically, we only quantitated delta-9 THC and CBD, but depending on what we saw, we may quantitate others as well. We also did quantitation of vitamin E acetate and medium chain triglycerides. And in all of these cases, we either had to take a compendial method and modify it for our use, or we took an in-house method and modified it for use with these products. Okay, so these are some examples of what the GCMS chromatograms look like for THC products. So on the left, this is a THC product with delta-9 THC, and then the green window is the retention window for the cannabinoids. And then on the right, this is a chromatogram that has a product that also contains vitamin E acetate, and you can see that it's very easily detected and separated from the cannabinoids with this method. And then the bottom chromatogram shows a THC product that also contains medium-chain triglyceride components. So this was a very useful technique to discern the THC as well as some of the other components present. For samples where we had a very limited amount of material, the ones that just contained a residue, we can do the FTIR, and then we would follow that up by DART, which is direct analysis in real time with high resolution accurate mass spectrometry. And using that technique, we can determine cannabinoids. We can also identify vitamin E acetate and MCT oil components, as well as indications of polyethylene glycol components to get some more information about these samples. And then on the nicotine side, nicotine products, we can identify nicotine using this method. Because in all cases, the submissions that we received are generally connected to a patient who's been ill, and so we wanted to be able to get as much information as we could for every submission. Also being conservative about the amount of material that we use, because we may want to do further testing on these products as more information is learned. So as of late February, I can share some results. We received, and by we, I mean FDA laboratories, have received approximately 1,500 samples from 31 states and one territory. Approximately 1,200 of those samples are directly connected to patients. On the nicotine side, we've analyzed about 280 nicotine products. And the findings on the nicotine side are generally consistent with what you would expect to see for a nicotine product. We detected nicotine, we detected propylene glycol and glycerol, and various flavors. On the THC side, we've tested approximately 620 samples. We found Delta-9 THC in those products at an average concentration of about 29%, but with a very wide range of 0.1 to 78% Delta-9 THC. About 50% of the THC products that we've tested contain vitamin E acetate. Generally speaking, the vitamin E acetate concentration is about 50%, with also a very wide range of 4 to 88% of vitamin E acetate in those products. About 15% of the THC products that we tested contain medium-chain triglycerides. They're about 9%, also with a pretty wide range of 0.2 to 29%. And I also wanted to point out that some products did contain both medium-chain triglycerides and vitamin E acetate. It wasn't necessarily an either-or proposition. So some others have talked about vitamin E acetate, so I don't want to belabor this too much, but it is vitamin E acetate is safe to consume. It's present in many different products as long as the consumption is ingestion. Medium-chain triglycerides are made by processing either coconut or palm kernel oil. They are used as a dietary fat source by some folks. They're readily available in the supermarket, also safe to consume. And when we find them in vaping liquids, it's trioctanoin, tridecanoin, and then some mixed triglycerides. And then we would sum those together to in our quantitation. So there's also the question of how did these substances get into these products. So these are some products that we've tested in our laboratory that have been marketed as diluents for THC oils that are to be used by the end user. And so Honeycut, for example, we tested in our lab and we found it to be essentially 100% vitamin E acetate. And then this Terps USA diluent contains medium-chain triglycerides. So this is one way that substances such as vitamin E acetate or medium-chain triglycerides can get into these products. Certainly, these products touch many hands during their production and distribution. And so this isn't the only way, but this is certainly a way that can happen. So in order to answer the myriad of questions that we've received about other potential contaminants, things that we've heard talked about a lot today, such as metals and pesticides and other things, we selected a subset of samples in which we received sufficient material to do additional testing. And so just to talk a little bit about that, metals is, of course, a very big question. So the metals testing that we did, we used ICP-MS analysis, and these are all acid-digested preps, and we monitored a number of different metals. We did encounter some difficulties with metals analysis. We're using 25 milligrams per prep, which is a pretty small amount for metals analysis. And the THC especially was a very sticky product to use, difficult to mix, and we saw a lack of homogeneity in these products, as you'll see. So I've got a lot of data here, but we looked at both nicotine and THC vaping liquids. And these results are for only four samples where we retrieve the material from the cartridge. Because one of the potential ways that metals can get into these liquids is from the cartridge itself. And so we did, on the nicotine side, we did receive, for example, refill solutions for nicotine products. But we didn't include those in this testing because we wanted to try to find the most likely contaminated samples. So for both the nicotine, and these are the THC products, we did find nickel, copper, and zinc at the higher levels, and these are some lower levels of metals that we found. We certainly didn't find metals in all samples that we tested. And then you'll notice very large error bars on the THC side because we had some tremendous variability between preps. So since we didn't have the ability to do additional preps of these particular samples because we were so limited in the amount of material that we had. And so since then, we've done some additional work to try to prep these samples a little bit differently in order to get some more consistent results. But this gives you an idea of the kinds of levels that we saw and what metals we saw. So on the pesticide side, we adapted an internal LC-MS pesticide screen for use with these products. This particular method includes 52 different pesticides, and we've tested 18 THC samples using this method. We found a number of different pesticides in the products that we tested. Now, it's important to say that we did not see all of these pesticides in every sample, and many samples contained no pesticides whatsoever. And mycobutanol and bifenthrinate were found more often than the others. And in this method, we had the ability to quantitate four pesticides, mycobutanol, bifenthrinate, tubaconazole, and metalaxyl. And then these are the ranges that we saw in the samples that in which we found these pesticides. We also did testing for endotoxins and mycotoxins. We used commercial kits in both cases. And then our detection limit on the endotoxins was 500 units per gram and 20 nanograms per gram on the mycotoxin side. The results were negative for all the samples that we tested using these methods. Okay. Our CDC partners, through doing some testing of clinical samples, have really zeroed in on vaping vitamin E acetate as the cause of the injuries for Evoli. So I just wanted to point that out. There have also been a lot of questions about the actual, like, what happens when the liquid is vaporized. And how does the liquid change? And so we also put together our own little homemade vaping system where we can capture some of the vapor and recondense it. And so in just using FTIR to look at these liquids, we made some mixtures of THC distillate with vitamin E acetate to see how the liquids change during the vaping process. So the bottom trace here is FTIR of a pre-vaped vitamin E acetate and THC mixture. And then the middle is an analysis of the vapor itself of the same mixture. And then the top trace is FTIR of the recondensed liquid. And from this, we can see that at least to the limit of detection of FTIR, we don't see a lot of difference in pre and post vape liquids just using this method. We have additional work ongoing looking at the temperatures that are achieved of the vapor to answer some of the questions about thermal stability of various chemicals in the vapes. Okay. And with that, we can conclude. We continue to test products that we've received. We still have a lot of testing to go to get through all of the patient life samples that we've received as part of this investigation. We are doing some additional work, both to improve our methods on the metal side and also to answer some other questions about the chemistry of these products. Diluents such as vitamin E acetate and medium chain triglycerides, as well as others, have been found in about 75% of the THC vaping liquids that we've tested. And clinical evidence published by CDC seems to indicate that vaping vitamin E acetate is certainly part of the cause of lung injury. Nothing that I've said here today is meant to endorse any product, and all of the views and opinions are mine alone and not those of the Food and Drug Administration. I'd like to thank the entire Forensic Chemistry Center staff for all of their work that they've done on this project. This was certainly an all-hands-on-deck experience for us. We're only about 60 scientists, and this was a tremendous amount of work. I'd also like to acknowledge the other laboratories within the Office of Regulatory Science and FDA who participated in this testing with us and continue to test products with us. And I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.